Hey folks, thanks for tuning into the BAMF podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty, and we've got a comics roundtable today where we'll be discussing about which pop culture villain you find the most distasteful and poorly written. And joining us today for this parade of vile is, Mr. Chris McLaughlin.
Hi.
Hey Chris, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure as always.
And for those of you who've listened to this, if you're listening to this podcast, there's no way you don't know who Chris is, but just to give you a quick preview, he's one of the esteemed Mutants and Masterminds writers. He wrote The Time of Crisis, Time of Vengeance, Hero High. You're working on Hero High and Rogues Gallery right now for Third Ed, right?
I'm writing a tiny bit of Hero High Revised. I don't want to scare anybody off because it was Lucien Solbon who makes those books awesome. He's just letting me write on his coattails in that one. And yes, but Rogues Gallery, all me so far.
Okay. And I guess speaking of Green Ronin writers, we need to include Abe in that category now, because he's working with you guys on a new project, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's Abe, you helped with Atlas for Earth Prime, and now you're working on Rogues Gallery with Mr. Chris?
That's correct.
Okay.
That is correct. I have submitted my villains ready to for approval, and we'll see what sticks to the wall and gets taken.
Now, you've had kind of a rising star in the RPG field. You started out working for small-time shops like Fane and Goat, and now you're working for Green Ronin. Has the fame and power gone to your head?
I have yet to buy my gold-plated bath, but that is on order. And, yes, the roller skates have been traded in for the Rolls Royce next week.
How do you deal with the gaming groupies?
At the moment, it's quite easy.
Okay, fair enough. Moving right along, Walt Rebillard, head of Hazard Studios, and let's call him the publisher of Supers, Revised Edition. How you doing, Walt?
I am all ready for my evil.
Damn, you're just going to leave me hanging with that. Okay. And last but not least, Dr. Comics himself, Jason Toundrow, is here to join us. How you doing, Jason?
I'm real well. I'm recovering from a cold, so if I sound a little stuffy in the head, that's not your audio giving you trouble.
All right, no worries. All right, well, hey, let's get things started with Chris, because I'm sure he's a man of many entertainingly articulated opinions. Chris, if we're talking about any villain anywhere in literature, comics, movies, who you thought was badly handled, who's the top of your list for that?
Well, I hope and pray I never live long enough to see a villain that was more poorly done than the big baddie behind DC's reboot, or maybe I should say reboot number 2, I think it was, Zero Hour. Extant, to me, typifies everything that you should absolutely not do as a villain.
Okay, how so?
Well, his one power is that he is pretty much undefeatable, and you know that's always boring for a reader. I mean, a villain who can do anything. I mean, come on, how are you supposed to make that? How are you going to make any kind of victory by the heroes credible against that? His motivation is that DC needed to do a reboot. Well, I mean, when we were talking about best villains, we talked about how important it is for a villain to have at least some understandable motivation, maybe even some sympathetic elements, talking about, you know, why Magneto is such a great villain. Well, Extant's reason for being is they needed somebody to make the reboot happen. Okay. First of all, let's get this name business out of the way. Extant? Oh, come on. Please. Please. Okay. Costume, you know, not Rob Liefeld bad, but just, you know, kind of a litany of some of the things that makes everybody, except the people currently running DC, hate 90s costume design in general. And just the way he was handled plot-wise, he comes out of nowhere and massacres the Justice Society of America. The original superheroes died, well, as much as anybody dies in comics, at the hands of this wanker from nowhere, who has had no build-up, no history, no motivation, and it's kind of his contribution. And there he goes. He gets to wipe out comics' original superheroes.
Yeah, I remember reading that story, and I was collecting JSA at the time, and I was like, mm-hmm. What the fuck did they just do?
Yeah. And the big reveal of the character is that he's one of the guys who used to be Hawk of Hawk and Dove.
Yeah, it's Hank Hall, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. and you know, had it been Irving Forbush, I think I would have been more amazed, because I'm like, hey, that's technically a Marvel guy. At least there was something to the reveal here. And, you know, I think maybe the ultimate disdain that for this character doesn't even belong to me. The fact that Geoff Johns resurrected him after like a decade of being justifiably forgotten just so he could kill him in one of his very first solo arcs writing JSA all by himself. And I mean, whatever else you might want to think of Geoff Johns, I happen to love Geoff Johns. I shook Geoff Johns' hand and just walked to him and said, thank you for so many great stories, thank you for so many great comics, and thank you for killing Extant. And he laughed.
Now, Extant was supposed to be Captain Atom, right?
Okay, going back a crossover to Armageddon 2001, yeah, the ultimate joke was that it was the ultimate bad guy there was going to be Captain Atom, but apparently spoilers leaked out and they had to switch it to Hank Hall.
And the villain's name in that book was Monarch.
Okay,
which
so Monarch
is
and
better. Okay. Better.
I have to say I didn't realize Monarch and Extant were the same guy, and I'm kind of a DC fan, so I suppose I should be ashamed, but it sounds like I didn't miss much there.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I guess the moral of it is, if I ever actually do meet Dan Jurgens face to face, I'm bringing along my copies of Zero Hour, not for him to sign, but for him to refund my money. So, Dan, if you're listening, cash or check is fine. You know, either way.
I know, Chris. I've had one DC writer listen to this podcast. And I'm pretty sure you scared him away.
Sorry.
Did I ever tell you about that?
Yes, you did, and I can't apologize enough for that.
It's okay. It's Scott Lobdell. God bless him, but you know it's Scott Lobdell.
Well, we know who his favorite villain is. Chris.
Yes. He sits on a big stack of Ike Perlmutter's money and just cries himself to sleep every night. This one cranky middle-aged political science professor makes fun of his work.
You never know. I mean, writers fixate. I once had Warren Ellis come to my LiveJournal blog about 7 years ago to yell at me because I wrote an unkind blog about one of his Wired articles. You know, I had like maybe 3 people reading my blog, and one of them was my girlfriend. And so your point is blah 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 blah. And I'm like, fucking hey, Warren Ellis is googling himself and coming to my LiveJournal to bitch about things that I say.
I still have to hug it out with everybody at Video Watchdog magazine. So maybe you're right. I don't know.
I never know. Michael Crichton apparently. Reviewers who he fixated on, who wrote stuff unkind about his work, he would work their names in his villains in future books.
Wow.
Yeah, so you never know. So, alright, so first one, Extant/Monarch/Hank Hall, horrible villain. Dr. Comics, what do you think?
Well, you stole Monarch, because Monarch was mine. I remember that 2001 crossover, and I mean, it's hard to find a more anticlimactic big bad guy than Hank Hall. but if I have to reach now for a new one, let's try to be fair here. Let's think Marvel. Let's see, really awful Marvel villains. Oh, can I go to like the whole like Carnage genre?
Yes.
All of those villains who are like awful knockoffs of heroes from the 90s, designed to be like serial killer versions of heroes. Right? And I want to note that I think there's a role for Venom in Spider-Man comics. I don't particularly like the character very much, but I understand the idea of the dark mirror kind of character archetype. And Venom is a perfectly good one of those. And I understand that his current incarnation is Flash Thompson. That's actually kind of genius. But then we had Carnage, and then weren't there like spin-offs of Carnage? Wasn't there like another clone?
Yes,
there's always another clone. There's
Toxic.
Always another clone.
Anti-Venom, wasn't there? There's Anti-Venom, which was
Anti-Venom,
Black.
Yes.
Yeah.
Was that the female version?
I can't honestly remember.
No, that wasn't the female version. That was it was the guy who was originally Scorpion.
Okay.
And he developed he developed like healing powers, and he uh, he was like everything that Venom wasn't, but he was still all messed up in the head, so nobody really wanted to associate with him until Dan Slott wrote Spider Island. Okay. And they used him as like, in case you haven't read it, everybody, don't get internet rage when I spoil that. They used him to save everybody from the spider virus that gripped Manhattan.
Well, there was like a female Carnage. I mean, I remember seeing covers of like Carnage with boobs, and this image is seared into my brain. So I don't know who that character was, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't the Scorpion.
Well, you know, I'm looking at a YouTube video that claims there were 10 symbiotes. There are 4 mentioned in the Wikipedia article: Venom, Carnage, Toxin, Anti-Venom.
Toxin. Let's see. Toxin.
Yeah, so pretty, sort of, I thought it was a toxin.
So pretty much I've got a symbiote at this point, right?
Yeah. Anyway, so like that whole craze, I mean, because that was just, God, that was awful. What in the world was going on in someone's head?
Jason, did you read the new Venom with Flash Thompson?
I have not. I've been trying to read more contemporary comics lately, and there's been some really great books out there.
It's really cool because of the fact that Thompson comes back from Afghanistan.
Yeah.
He's got both of his legs amputated because he was in an IED attack.
Yeah.
And they give him the symbiote as a way to get this because he was a special forces operator, and they use the symbiote to get him back in the game. But they tackle a lot of issues in that, not just the obvious like PTSD and stuff like that, but his relationship with his father, his control over the symbiote, the whole idea of superheroics versus how a soldier would operate in that role, and it's I'm kind of disappointed that they let it go.
Oh, did it get canceled?
Yeah, God, I can't remember how many issues. I originally bought the first 10, and then I've been reading the rest on Marvel Unlimited. So yeah. I mean, it's just it kind of disappointed me because you know there was a lot of good stuff in there that I really enjoyed.
Well, I mean,
he's in the Guardians of the Galaxy now, isn't he?
He is in Guardians, yeah.
Well, yeah. I think it's great, especially because I did not know that he was disabled. He was physically disabled, and I think that's great. And I have students in my classes who are veterans, you know, and so they're going to read that comic like you, and they're going to read that comic, and they're going to think, how come these characters act in such an unrealistic fashion? And so to give them a character who they can identify with. I think that's great, and this is, I mean, at one hand, it's kind of a relevancy comic issue where we're trying to take a character and make him more relevant, but I also like the diversity issue where we take a guy who's sort of classically white, male, heterosexual, and make him something other than the typical superhero by making him paraplegic.
Well, he struggles with dealing with the wheelchair, and the comic, it really, once it starts getting like deep into it, because they only let him wear it for so many hours at a time.
Oh, I see. So he spends most of his days still in the chair.
In a chair, and the reason they do that is they don't want the symbiote to bond too closely with him that they don't end up with Venom, and they give him drugs to counteract the symbiote's effects afterwards. But the comic starts going into themes of addiction because he becomes not only addicted to still being able to walk and becomes almost clinically depressed when he can't.
Yep.
But he struggles with almost like he starts having relationship trouble with Betty, his on and off girlfriend, because he starts thinking about the symbiote while he's with her in his regular life,
yeah,
you know, and it's really interesting. A couple of, you know, I mean, for most some of my other friends that read it that looked at it and weren't too into it, they were like, meh, whatever. But I mean, you know, when I looked at it, I saw all these issues, and I'm like, wow, that's, you know, and it's not so slap you in the face that you can't read the book, but it was good enough to where it held my attention.
So there's something there about veterans reintegrating into society, and there's something there about like pain med addiction and depression and clinical depression and stuff. Yeah, so it sounds and great.
Even phantom limb pain too, because at some point he talks about his waking up and he gets out of bed and goes to stand, and then has to catch himself because his legs aren't there.
You know, Wallace's point is, I think, helps us illustrate that. I don't know if there are some pretty bad villains out there, but even a bad villain given to a decent writer, something can be made good out of it. Now, there are some villains that this is harder to do with. I mean, there's only so much you can do with Egg Foo. But and you know what I'm talking about. You know who Egg Foo is. But
sadly, I do.
Yeah. And I remember when John Byrne tried to make Egg Foo interesting, and I'm like, John, not even you, man.
You didn't like the 52 reboot?
I didn't see it.
Yeah, I loved him in that.
I didn't see it.
Yeah, they just made him into a bizarre mutant mad scientist, and they gave him a more legitimately Chinese sounding name.
okay, fair enough.
So Aid, Aid and Wald, who wants to go first?
I won't
go first because I can't think of anything. No, go Wald, go.
Oh,
you've had
yeah.
your talk. I'm completely thinking, who do I really, really hate? And I'm having the trouble at the moment, so.
You can use bad Doctor Who villains if you need, you know, the softball.
Well, funny enough, there is a bad Doctor Who villain that immediately came to mind, but that's probably going to be lost to most people, so.
Oh, no, rock and roll, dude. After you.
Okay, right. The worst villain in the cast is what I cast the pantomime villain, okay? The pantomime villain just stands there and has no threat whatsoever and just kind of waves around going, I'm going to get you! There is a Doctor Who episode where there is basically, the entire point of it is the Arachnos is this giant spider queen woman who's got loads of millions of spiders, and she's like 15 feet tall, and normally, like in Dungeons and Dragons, she'd be, you know, clawing at people, you know, claw, bite, oh dear, 2d6 damage, they're dead. In Doctor Who, she stands there and waves around her arms going, eee! For about 15 minutes. That's it. That's her extent of her powers. And it's complete waste of a really, really cool-looking bad guy. So that kind of villain that basically just stands there and has absolutely zero... I mean, it, obviously in comics, not so much, because obviously you can do stuff, but in television, especially the ones that just kind of like, they're the big bad, but they do nothing. I mean, Buffy the Vampire Slayer may have had a couple because, you know, we haven't got the effects budget to do this, that, and the other to make them fly or make them teleport or make them burst into green flame or whatever. They're the guys I hate.
That's awesome.
I can't argue. Sleaze tacks always bother me for the same reason. Actually, the sleaze tacks would fit nicely as a Doctor Who villain, wouldn't they? From that same kind of stuff. Because I mean, the sleaze tacks and went the you guys remember the sleaze tacks from American television in the '70s, Saturday morning, Land of Time Forgot.
Land of the Lost. Oh no, the ones.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, there those reptile men who couldn't shoot crossbows to hit anybody. It is literally
yeah,
creepy.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So what you're saying is they were proto stormtroopers.
Yeah. They were. Yeah, yeah. I think I could easily see Tom Baker fighting them.
Yeah. Just ineffectual bad guys. I mean, the weird thing is we've got at the moment is that back in the day on the 60s, or especially in the 60s and 70s, or at least the perception was, you could write a Spider-Man comic with be like, Doctor Doom is going to break into the bank and steal some money. You don't get that kind of stories anymore. It's always much more. It's very rarely you get like a actual threat that's kind of in a area that can be stopped, and then it's always kind of like some drawn out plan that lasts for 57 issues that they're kind of manipulating 80,000 people to do something that, you know, anyway, it's just really strange that you don't get that kind of thing. The entire, I mean, in role playing games, generally speaking, you put you put bad guys against your characters in a room, job done. In comics, doesn't happen that often now.
Well, I think it has to do a lot with how the audience has changed and the media they have access to. I mean, you go back to the golden age of a guy invents a gun that reduces everything to absolute zero, decides to use it to rob banks, that's like the 40s through the 60s, when your average comic reader is, you know, not only probably a kid, whatever news they get is going to be coming from their local newspaper, where something like a bank robbery is going to be big news. Well, nowadays, you know, even the youngest kid is probably carrying around a cell phone that has more technology in it than we used to put a guy on the moon. He's getting news reports about terrorist attacks halfway across the globe. And, you know, sadly, we live in a world where every day people are getting beheaded and burned alive in the Middle East by ISIS, ISIL, whatever you want to call them. And somehow, you know, just sending, a bank robber at a hero, it seems so out of touch with what we're actually afraid of these days.
That's very true. I mean, you know, I'm reading Batman Eternal at the moment, and Batman Eternal, I think, has had now three potential manipulator villains that could have done it, and then it's yes, so there's only one. There's one more tier, and then it's somebody else that done it as well. So it's that, you know, reflecting back to role playing games, obviously, like we normally do as well. I can believe if you were trying to throw that at players would be really, really annoyed about just one more tier. They would get slightly irate. They want to capture the guy and be done with it, and yeah, maybe one or two, but just to keep going, there's one more guy out there. That would bug them.
I think Chris's point is right on, and also I think that starting in about the 60s, and we're really probably more like the 70s, when comic writers began to try to make the villains more identifiable and sympathetic. So we tended to get a lot of characters like Doom and Magneto. Magneto's a great example, where, you know, he would have a big plot, but it's all about making the world safe for my people, you know, like, and robbing a bank, these kinds of short-term, get-in-a-room-and-fight kind of incidents, those aren't really great story elements in a big, overarching, kind of self-identifiable, honorable villain kind of plotline.
Okay, so can you think of a recent Doctor Doom plot, though, that actually is memorable? Because I can think of lots of ones during the 60s, obviously I've been reading the Fantastic Four omnibuses, that have got like, okay, Doom's trying to achieve this. But recently, it just seems to be kind of just floating around doing things. It's nothing kind of like a big something. It just seems to be there.
Doom is one of those villains that can be written really, really well and really poorly. My favorite Doom story ever is Triumph and Torment, the Doctor Doom, Doctor Strange team-up written by Roger Stern and drawn by Mignola, where they rescue his mother's soul from Mephisto. And that book is just genius, but partly the reason why I love it is because it's Mignola when he's early and he hasn't really kind of clarified his Hellboy art style yet. But yeah, modern writers don't really know what to do with Doom, and the fact that his film presentations have not helped matters any.
But they're going to fix that in the reboot.
Oh yeah,
of course. Yeah. Now he's a blogger. I mean, that's it. We've got a thousand different stories coming out of that.
You know, there was like a Doctor Doom story in Mark Waid's run on Daredevil.
Really?
Yeah, the underworld was going nuts because somebody had a flash drive that was made from some device that the Fantastic Four left on a battlefield that contained a lot of incriminating information on Megacrime, being like AIM and the Secret Society and Hydra. And Dr. Doom was somehow going to use it to blackmail all those organizations. Mm-hmm. And then there was a big battle in New York, and Matt Murdock got his hands on it and gave it to the Avengers for safekeeping, and then Doom teleported him to Latveria to torture him for stealing that from him.
Wow.
And there was a couple issues where Matt tried to escape from his castle and get out. And it's Mark Waid, so I mean it was great. But that's the only good Doctor Doom I can think of, except for the Fantastic Four stuff when they're doing the Battle of the Four Cities.
That was Hickman, right?
Hickman, yeah. And that was, Doom was teamed up with Reed Richards' kids fighting multiversal threats, and then all the different, I mean, there was some weird Doom stuff, like all the different multi-use, the League of Reed Richards, they had a collection of Dooms with lobotomies they kept in their basement.
Yes.
And that was memorable, but just creepy as hell.
My point about these identifiable villains, sympathetic villains, is, and this I'm trying to get back to what Abe was talking about the difference between comic books and gaming. In order to make a villain sympathetic, you have to spend a lot of time with him. And you can't really do that at a gaming table, unless the villain has joined the hero team. You spend all of your time with the players. And you can't really do an 8-page scene in which you reveal that the absorbing man's girlfriend is dying of cancer. And so that's why... And so that's why he's going out and robbing a bank, so that he can buy her medical treatment, you know?
Yeah.
That scene is impossible at the gaming table. And you can explain it later. They can grab him, and he can say, why are you doing this? I'm just trying to get money for my girlfriend's cancer treatment. But because it doesn't have the 8-page build-up, you don't really buy it. It doesn't really sell. And I don't know where I'm going with that, but it's the difference between comic book villains and RPG villains.
That sounds like a good argument for having someone in a supporting cast be a secret villain.
Yeah.
And there is a way to write that story.
Oh, tell me.
Not to brag or anything, but as humbly as I can, Time of Vengeance, or maybe I should say, okay, all right, why stop here? The award-winning Time of Vengeance.
Oh, nice.
All right. it's the Ten Commandments meets Dr. Fibes meets Citizen Kane. But it's the battles lead the players through bits and pieces of my boss villain's past. So by the time that you finally get to the final boss, spoiler alert on something that came out 10 years ago? All right, okay. Whatever. By the time you finally meet the boss villain, you have managed to piece together at least the major chunks of her life, kind of like the unseen guy in Citizen Kane knows all but the one crucial thing about Kane. And Time of Vengeance sort of builds to that one moment. And in fact, if you've been paying attention to her life, you know how to beat this insanely powerful villain without firing a shot. So it is possible. It's just it's not easy, but it's possible.
Yeah, well, I totally buy that. Yeah, it is very, very difficult, and that means it's worth doing. I mean, if it's hard to do, then that's worth doing. But in today's RPG environment, it's often hard to find the time and energy to invest in that. But if you can, then yeah, right. It pays off.
And then you have to go out and find people to buy your adventures.
Yeah, exactly.
Adventures are a hard sell. Hey, yeah. So Walt, Mr. Rebilliard, how would you weigh in on this subject?
Oh, yeah, the pages and pages I could do. villains turned good guys. I hate it. Let's back up a little bit, okay? Magneto, okay? One of my favorite villains on the last villains podcast that we did, and please see the Banff podcast page for access links to that particular podcast. Chris and Jason went into explicit detail of how Magneto is an identifiable villain because he's not really, even in his own head, coming across as a villain. He just doesn't want to go through another genocide. So when he periodically aligns with the X-Men, it's not so much that he's, you know, like... that he's going, I'm not bad anymore. I'm just misunderstood, and I'm going to work with you guys now. He's not doing that. He's using the tools that he has access to at the time to accomplish his goals. And I can get behind that. That's fine. Something like they did in Dark Reign Marvel Comics, where the villains are pretending to be bad guys, I can do that too. And that's a reversal of the reversal of the Thunderbolts idea that is in the superbly penned Supervillains Handbook at Kickstarter right now. I do what I can. But the
awkward segue man to the rescue.
Hey man, if I got to use a clue by four, I'll do it. But that I can get behind too, because it's villains pretending to, just like, you know, the reverse Thunderbolts idea, where the heroes are pretending to be bad, it's the villains pretending to be bad to attain some sort of goal. I can get behind that as well. Fantastic, rock and roll. What kills me is guys like Sabretooth. He is a homicidal maniac who's just been in love with killing since the day he was first debuted in The Marauders. And now that Wolverine is gone, he's working at the Jean Grey School. He's doing, you know, he's, and it's like, just, what's that?
It doesn't make sense. Exactly.
Exactly. Does not make any sense.
Now, I mean, I just want to note that that's not Sabretooth's first appearance.
As a good guy.
No, Sabretooth's first appearance is in Iron Fist.
Oh, that's right.
When he owned a corporation and was a smart guy. I know. It's like a totally different character. Like, Claremont invents this guy in Iron Fist, and he lures Iron Fist out onto the snow to make Iron Fist go snowblind. And he's like the head of this like bizarre evil corporation, and then he gets completely recreated to be Wolverine's archenemy.
I forgot all about that.
I know. And I hate to throw that in because you can tell it's just somebody decided to throw that out and get a better idea. But
even the idea they went to, I mean, they put the poor bastard in a wrestling singlet to fight Wolverine. I mean, you know, he's got his junk hanging out all over the pages. He's fighting with claws and teeth. And I thought for a second I was dealing with an S&M villain. You know, I'm 15 years old when I'm reading this comic. I'm like, what the hell am I looking at?
I wouldn't be surprised if they decided that was like Sabretooth's twin brother or something that we saw in Iron Fist. Like they're so dissimilar.
You know, but I mean, even look at the Death of Wolverine storyline, I think, was a way for Marvel Comics to bring all of those villains out and get you to identify with them so that they could use them later in some sort of, you know, grandiose whatever. Because, I mean, you got Sabretooth running around like, you know, don't worry, I'll mentor you. You got Deken coming out like, well, I really hated my father when he was alive and I tried to kill him every chance I get, but let's try and live up to an ideal Wolverine.
And they also fall into the same thing you were saying about Venom. It's again, it's like it's Wolverine, but I've got two claws on my hands rather than three. Different.
You know, but then I mean, even worse is you know, a step above that where you totally twist the modus operandi of a villain to make him good, just to put him in a different role. Harry Osborn and Lex Luthor. All right, let's backtrack and look at what they went through for 50 plus years of comics writing, where they've tried to destroy the world 100 times, mass murder, billions and billions of dollars in property destruction, but we're going to let one guy lead a super secret organization for the United States government to clean up the superheroes, and we're going to let the other guy become the president of the United States. I got nothing.
Well, in defense of it, I can see where the post-crisis Lex Luthor would be president. That makes perfect sense to me. I mean, if you forget, you know, the all the 70s, I became bad because my hair fell out, which, by the way, is my supervillain origin.
Yeah, you know, I'm down for that one.
That makes more sense than the Osborne thing. Okay. Two quick points. First of all, I want to be the first one to get it in as a joke, so I can look like it when it really happens. Eventually, Marvel will do Super Mega Plus Wolverine, and his shtick will be that he's got four claws on each hand. And secondly, I just want to throw in a story I can tie together two of other guests' points. There is this astonishingly good read. It's this insanely detailed month-by-month breakdown of the whole Spider-Clone saga, including a lot of really, really amazingly insightful and candid interviews with the people that were having to crank out comics for bankruptcy-era Marvel. And it just the point where they all just break at the, you know, when they're asked to keep this thing going for another year to get one more spin-off book out of it. Well, the one point where the writers actually just jumped up and said no more was the bosses of bankruptcy era Marvel decided that Carnage needed to become a good guy and get his own title.
Oh wow!
And that's the one point where they just said no, forget it. We are not turning Carnage into a hero.
Nice. Yeah. Well, good. Good for them.
And then there was an awkward silence on the BAM podcast.
I killed the podcast dead. Sorry.
But that's what the host is for, Mike.
Indeed. All right, so I'm going to weigh in. And this is, honestly, I hate the Joker, the way he's been written since about the Killing Joke. But this subject has kind of been run into the ground. I mean, you can talk about the Killing Joke quite a bit, and Alan Moore's largely disowned it as being a kind of a clumsy story he wasn't very proud of, and I think the issue of women in the refrigerator is what they did to Barbara Gordon for really no good reason has kind of been run into the ground. But for me, that kind of started, you know, the trend of overwriting the Joker, or, you know, that was the story that humanized him the most. But I think I think just kind of having him go to the extent that he did, crippling a superhero and, you know, having weird midgets and S&M gear, it seemed like it started the trend of all of a sudden the Joker, you know, now he's, you know, in the Death of the Family storyline in DC, he was, he walked into a precinct house and killed like 20 cops in the same room with them. And then later on he left Batman a clue that was the stitched intestines of 40 people, you know, as kind of a mosaic mural, you know, as a clue. And it just becomes kind of this weird horror, like Saw hostile villain as opposed to a supervillain. So far from the origin as kind of a, you know, a goofy theme villain, I think he sort of gets removed from any kind of, reality. Now he's a crazy guy who's...
I just want to interject something, Kate.
Yeah, yeah.
It gets away from one conception of the Joker. That's definitely not Cesar Romero right there.
Oh,
but
yeah,
but if you go back and read the Joker in Batman 1, he's killing people left and right pretty much as violently and disgustingly as you can get away with in a children's comic in 1940.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
I think that the reinvention of Batman in Dark Knight Returns and then Year One had a lot to do with Moore's portrayal of Joker in Killing Joke. I remember that Miller had portrayed Batman as maybe a little more than a little crazy in his portrayal. Remember, this is a Batman that hallucinates a giant bat. Which has later continued to appear in things like the Chris Nolan movies and stuff. And when Batman gets a little crazy, you know, when he gets pushed, his envelope gets pushed, I think that it maybe gives more of an opportunity to push Joker. And also, I think Moore is trying to... I mean, I hate to try to imagine what Moore is thinking, because that's just that's a trip down insanity, but...
You'll be praying to the Lizard God any minute now.
Yeah, exactly. but part of how Killing Joke works, and I do like it as a story, is that it makes you sympathize with the Joker. When he tells his story of trying to make money as a stand-up comedian so he can help his wife have a baby. And the challenge as a writer on that book is to make the Joker as awful as possible and yet retain your sympathy for him. Like, it would be easy to write that book if the Joker didn't really do anything bad. If all that he did was have a surf contest with Batman and see who was king of the beach, then it would be very easy to sympathize with him because, you know, he didn't do anything really that bad. But when he's a terrible sociopath who cripples a fan-favorite character and takes pictures of her naked, then that makes the writer's job much harder. And say what you want for Alan Moore, he tries to do hard things. Now, whether or not he succeeded or not, that's another debate. But I think that's what went on there. And I do agree with you, Mike. It did push the character into begin a push that has continued to the present day. And I really like your observation about Saw. I think you're right. I think there was a kind of horror movie aesthetic that took over the Joker for a while.
Well, but, I mean, we're talking about a character that's based on a horror movie, The Man Who Laughs from 1928.
Right.
I can understand why some people are uncomfortable with this interpretation of the character, but I don't lose a minute's sleep thinking that this is a valid interpretation of this character, every bit as much as Cesar Romero or Mark Hamill.
Morrison had this really interesting observation about Joker when he was writing Batman, and that's that because he tried to treat all of these versions of Batman, of Joker, all of these different versions of Joker as canon. And his argument was that the Joker is sort of intentionally recreating himself to be whatever popular horror is at the time. And I can't really articulate that debate with too many specifics because it's been too long since I read Morrison's run on Batman. But this kind of fits with what you're saying, Chris, you know, that different creators have taken Joker and they've each tried to make him scary or campy in the case of Batman 66. and if you're going to treat the character as one character, you have to come up with an explanation for that. And Morrison's is as good as anything.
The new spin on the Joker at the moment is also that he's possibly immortal, isn't it?
Yeah, he's older than Gotham, and he's been plaguing Gotham since its creation.
Yeah, that's a possibility. It hasn't been established yet because the people lie and stuff. But I don't know about that.
Never confirmed that.
I have two thoughts I want to get out. Number one, the idea that the Joker changes himself to suit whatever the modern horror genre is doing makes me think that a found footage horror movie featuring, you know, a bunch of student filmmakers in Gotham being terrorized by the Joker would actually be kind of fun to watch.
That you're right.
That'd be cool, yeah.
And number two, I guess what I'm getting down to is there was a scene in the Death of the Family storyline where someone asked Batman why he hasn't killed the Joker.
Yeah.
You know, because he's, even by Batman's code of ethics, and hey, we can debate that for 3 hours, we don't have to. There's a point where you could say, doesn't he have it coming? Isn't the world just better if you kill him? And Batman doesn't say it would violate my code of ethics, which would be in character. Batman says, I would kill him, but I'm afraid Gotham would come up with something worse.
Yeah, I don't buy that.
I think the killing joke is always going to be the ultimate answer of why he doesn't kill him.
But now, didn't Alan Moore say that was supposed to be he was supposed to die at the end?
No, you're thinking of, I believe that was Morrison's reinterpretation of the book, and he's not the only one. Julian Darius made the same argument. But Chris, tell me what you mean when you say that's a definitive answer.
Well, I mean, can I spoil Killing Joke?
it
was his sled.
Can you?
It was his sled. Okay, there you go. Anyway, well, you know, the fact that they basically just wander off laughing out loud at this joke that the Joker has thrown out, it kind of implies that Batman's a little nuts himself.
Yeah.
And I've always, I mean, that's the interpretation of that character that's always made the most sense to me.
I would just like to say that back on the martial arts podcast we did a couple of weeks ago, I would really like to see Chuck Rice's final battle scene play out, the Punisher versus the Joker, and have one of them die because, you know. But the fact that some government agency, some city agency of Gotham, some, like, crazed citizens haven't... I mean... Normal people beat Hitler. Captain America didn't do it. Normal people, you know, they beat his regime. However you want to look at it, you know, they took out that regime. The fact that this guy is still rolling around after all this time, Batman sucks at his job, and the people of Gotham should have every politician replaced.
And well, that's not fair because you know why the Joker doesn't die. That's because he sells comic books.
That's right. Absolutely.
They can't kill him. So saying, well, everybody in the world is incompetent because the Joker is still alive, instead we have to say, wait a minute, how can we explain the fact that they haven't killed him yet without them being incompetent? How can we defend this?
Well, I've always been colored by it's a rather throwaway line, but do you remember Underworld Unleashed? Of course you don't. But it was a Mark Waid DC crossover, so you should go back and check that out.
Yes.
But the framing issues are written from the perspective of James Jesse the Trickster.
Okay.
And he goes to the big villain meeting with the demon out of curiosity more than anything else, and he starts looking around and taking stock of all the other villains. And he's not impressed until he sees the Joker there, and he's like, oh my God! You know, he says, when ordinary people want to scare each other, they tell stories about us. When a supervillain wants to scare another supervillain, he tells him a Joker story.
Yeah, right. Good. Yeah.
And I just like to accept that he's just that freaking dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, he is that universe's Carlos the Jackal or Osama bin Laden. You know, he is that guy that does have the whole world after him, and they still can't get him.
But I would like to actually see something that was just mentioned a second ago. I would like to see them write maybe the Joker going away Supermax prison or him dying, however they wanted to do it, and see what Gotham spit out to replace him. That's a story I would love to see.
Well, that would, that story would end with the Joker getting out of jail and killing that guy. That's how that story would end. And taking his position back. There's a superhero story, and we've all read them, in which the hero is temporarily replaced by an inferior version, who then becomes a negative example of how not to be a superhero. The definitive example is probably Azrael. Occasionally you get the James Rhodes version, in which the hero, the replacement, is actually better than the original version, because this is when Tony was alcoholic and Rhodes took over. But usually it's a negative example. And so the story that you just described is the villain version of that story, in which somebody else would become a new villain that tries to intentionally take the Joker's position in the criminal hierarchy. And he's somehow not as cool and not as interesting. And then the Joker would break out of prison and whack him.
They actually just did that with the Penguin not long ago as well.
Oh, did they?
The guy who was his subordinate basically decided that because Cobblepot was basically sitting around just running a nightclub all night, he would just basically call himself King Penguin, and he would take over and be the next Penguin. I think he comes to a pretty grisly end at the end.
Let me throw a caution at you, if I may. Okay. All right. If part of what makes the Joker work and part of what makes the Joker make any kind of sense is that he is the most dangerous, most uncatchable, most unconquerable criminal in the whole DC universe, and you do ship him out and you try to come up with somebody that's going to top that, granted there are much more talented writers out there than me, but how do you make that not be extant?
Yeah, well, the point is that person would inevitably fail. I mean, he would, in the same way that Azrael was not able to be Batman.
How do you make him credible without just saying he can do anything? Why does he do it? Because he does.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm more confident in my ability to make a. I would totally play up the '90s stuff. Honestly, he'd be like the worst, like a Liefeld Joker, right? Like, it just, and he'd be kind of awful at it, which would be the point. Like, he'd be totally, like, over the top. And then the Joker would come back and take his place back. And it would be not only a story about ensuring that the Joker is that guy that you've described, but also a criticism of the story itself, of the need to constantly supplant and make things bigger and bigger and bigger and better.
Now, I'm not sure, because I've heard, like, 10 different ways to say this guy's name. Ra's al Ghul, Ra's al Ghul. Has he ever tried to take out the Joker?
I don't know.
Not that I know of.
Not that I'm aware of, but I think I vaguely remember stuff about Ra's and the Joker in the Lazarus Pits, but that may have been just a one story. Maybe the Joker is going to be taking him over or what, I don't know. But...
Because it seems to me like the Joker would be a target for that guy, wouldn't he?
Well, if there was a good story to come out of it.
Well, maybe in the Batman 66 animated movie, they'll have Ra's and the Joker play Pinochle or go bowling or something.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. A bowling competition. Ra's al Ghul versus the Joker. Perfect.
I would just take my money right now.
He could be king of the lane.
Actually, I was trying to be facetious, but now I kind of like the idea.
Yeah. Yeah. I really think it needs to be Romero Joker.
Well, it's for the, well, you've heard about this, right, Jason, right? They're doing the animated Batman 66 with Burt Ward and
okay. Julie Newmar is in it too now.
Is she? Oh my
really?
God.
Yes. Excellent.
That's I hope they do the same thing with the Wonder Woman 78, Wonder Woman 77 they've been doing.
Yeah.
I'd like to see Linda Carter get some. Hey, Chris, can I shift subjects radically and ask if you're doing anything with the Titan's Grave stuff at Green Ronin?
With the what now?
Today it was announced on the it was announced that on his tabletop show, Will Wheaton's going to be using the Dragon Age engine, which you guys are releasing, just calling Fantasy Age.
Yes.
As a his YouTube RPG, and it's going to be, I guess you guys are releasing a game version of what he's, I mean, what he's going to be playing, Titan's Grave, The Ashes of Volcana, is the title they've got, and you guys are publishing Titan's Grave, Ashes of Volcana, World and Adventure Book.
I'm sorry to be the most useless, worthless guest of all time on this score, but I was born without the fantasy gene, so they don't even really bother sharing the fantasy stuff with me because they know when they start talking about it, their eyes glaze over.
And I'm completely
my eyes glaze over. Yeah. And the extent of my knowledge to Will Wheaton is, I mean, I'm probably the only Green Ronin that doesn't like have that doesn't have like a room in his house set aside for them before they pop over to visit. We once had a 5-minute conversation in the booth entirely about pit bulls. And that's all I understand he was on some space show at one point, but that's kind of all the Will Wheaton I know.
Yeah, I think he was on Battlestar Galactica, maybe, was it? Or Space 19?
Oh, he was the kid with the robot dog.
Yeah, okay. So, all right. I literally just saw this on the GreenRunner.com blog, and I just thought I would ask just in case, you know.
Yeah. But, it's a terrific little engine, and I hope that it finds its niche out there. I understand that there's another big fantasy game sort of looming over everything at the moment, but you know, hopefully it's a quality design. Hopefully it'll find some room out there.
Yeah, I was just when he said he was going to do
this. Sorry, Mike.
Oh, no, I just, he played the Blue Beetle on an episode of Batman the Brave and the Bold. I was hoping he was going to do DC Adventures, but yeah, that's it. So, what were you saying, Aid?
I was going to say, that's why I think it's, I watch Tabletop every week, and that's why I think it's such a cool idea that they've picked something that's not Dungeons & Dragons. It's nice to see that he's decided to focus on something slightly off-center, and yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I think it should be a really good show.
Yeah, and folks, if you ever meet Will Wheaton at a convention, talk to him about animal husbandry in general, or perhaps pit bulls in particular.
He's a big campaigner against breed-specific legislation, and if he couldn't steal my wife's heart any more than he already has.
Yeah, I once rescued a stray pit bull on Colfax in Denver, and sweetest animal you could want. I mean, the whole drive to the Humane Society, I was waiting for him to bite my head off, but nicest dog you could ever want, and you got him adopted out, and last I heard he was still okay, so I'm with him on that. So
my wife loves you too.
that's how I got my dog. Tess is part pit bull, and I walked in and I said, okay, who's the dog that you can't place? There she was, so I said, I'll take her.
Yep. Well, sweet. Glad that worked out. Hey, speaking of things that work out, it's time for another awkward segue.
Awkward segue, man!
Sorry. Here at Fandango Games, we've been doing a book that we call The Supervillain Handbook. It's written by our own Dr. Comics, Mr. Jason Tondro. And I'll just give a brief description. I'll let Jason go into more detail. It's a list of 40 supervillain archetypes with accompanying stats for icons and the Supers RPG. And we've got it up on Kickstarter right now. If you go to Kickstarter and just search The Supervillain Handbook, you'll find us. And we have raised over $2,000 in the last 3 days. Our total goal is $3,000, so we're pretty chuffed about all that. Of course, we've got stretch goals. So you should check that out, and I'm going to hand the mic over to Jason now so he can give us some more gnarly details.
Yeah, sure, and I'm delighted to do that. And I want to thank everybody who's been so wonderful. You know, I've never really launched a Kickstarter where I was the writer before, the primary author, and so it's been wonderful to see support from so many wonderful people. The idea behind the Supervillain Handbook is that it's a story generator, and it talks about these archetypes not necessarily in terms of their powers, but rather in terms of what stories you use that villain to tell. So to touch back on some of the characters that we've been talking about in tonight's session, somebody like the Joker, for example, he's a psychopath archetype. What his powers are is kind of irrelevant. I mean, he kills people for no good reason. That's really all that matters about him. He's crazy. That's his important character trait. And so you use him to tell stories about insanity and about a villain that cannot be reasoned with, that cannot be sympathized with, and who does things beyond what other villains would do. That incredibly scary we tell stories about the Joker kind of stuff that Chris was very much on target with. When the psychopath is that guy, the guy that other villains are afraid of because you never know what he'll do. And this allows us to talk about archetypes in a way that, quite frankly, can be more original and more innovative, because I think that when we do archetypes, we can fall into a habit of making your Joker clone villain and your Mr. Mixes Pitlick villain and your Bizarro villain, and you just end up kind of rewriting the DC Adventures handbook. You know, you end up rewriting all of these villains over and over again. Instead, let's talk about what stories they're used and try to keep the powers out of it as much as we can. This has a nice side benefit of making the book actually kind of system neutral. I mean, it does have some specifics and icons about qualities and attributes and things like that. And we supplied some stat blocks so that you could open up the book and use it right away, and those stat blocks are on icons. But icons is a very simple game system that is very similar to Fate or Face Rip. And quite frankly, I think you could take those stats and convert them into your own favorite game system very simply, very quickly. Most of the entries, and there's 40 entries, and each one is about 1,000 words, talking not only about abilities and qualities, what can the character do, what can the villain do, and how does the villain do them, but also stories and famous examples from comics and television and film. So the entries are very long, so we have a lot of time to get very specific and talk about famous storylines from the comics, for example, and how you can use that story idea and maybe work it into your own game.
Yeah, I guess one thing we should point out is that a lot of Kickstarters, you kind of give them your money, and then you go into a time warp, and a year and a half later, a book finally shows up, vaguely resembling what you were promised. We've actually written the damn book.
Yeah, the whole book is done. Abe, who's here, has done a beautiful layout job with it. We got 5 or 6 different artists to come in and already illustrate it. The text is not quite 50,000 words. If you donate even a single dollar, you get the whole text-only version of the book. For $10, you get the laid-out PDF. For $25, I think, you get the print-on-demand copy. And what we're really going for, we're getting close to our goal, but what I'm personally hoping for is the expanded edition, the deluxe edition. If we do that, and that's at $4,000, I think. Walt, is that right?
Yeah, I believe so. 3,800, okay. I think.
If we can hit the deluxe edition, that means I write basically a whole nother book. I write another 40,000 or 50,000 words and add 40 villains, 40 fully developed, new, unique villains, one for every archetype, all of them fitting together into a public domain universe, the YO universe, or call it the universe. And that's all of these villains... of various power levels and different campaign styles. So if you prefer your crime bosses and cult masterminds to your cosmic heroes and ultimate villains, and we'll add all of that. And I really want to write those, because we designed a lot of these heroes in concept already, working with the artists. So for example, when Jacob Blackman, who's done just a crap load of fantastic art for us on this book, when we were designing each individual archetype, I would say, okay, well, here, you know, come up with a girl, a kid playing with fire archetype. And so he did this amazing, like, magical girl, except that she was trained in, like, an evil school for Satan. And she's taught magic. She's taught evil Satan magic by her talking cat, who's actually a demon. And I would never have thought of that concept in a million years, because I don't read Magic Girl comics at all. So, big surprise. And so the artists have really created most of these character concepts, which is great. And so all I get to do is they've done the really tough work. So now I get to go in and write about 1,000 words about their powers and their background and their origin and what kind of adventures you would do with them and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, just really to draw a line under it, all those villains and all the art accompanying those villains are going to be public domain.
That's right.
So it's a good resource for game masters, good resource for publishers. So something to check out. And If it's not too cheesy, I got a quote from Steve Kenson, who was here last week.
Steve loves this book. What do you say?
Villains are a mainstay of superhero games. Who's going to challenge the heroes from week to week if not a reliable rogues gallery of villains? Supervillain Handbook gives you enough ideas and archetypes for endless gameplay, and its discussion of classic villain archetypes is useful for all superhero games, beyond just icon superpowered role-playing. If superhero role-playing games are your thing, then you want this book.
There you go.
Steve. And I didn't give Steve $20 for that quote.
We gave him nothing, except a copy of the book. We gave him that.
And a Fainting Goat snack cake, but yeah.
A genuine no prize. Fainting Goat no prize.
So anyway, hey, we're on Kickstarter. It's an awesome project. You should check it out. I don't know how much longer we can shamelessly pimp this. Walt, you got your pimp hand strong? Or?
Yeah, if you don't back this project, I'm sending the Joker to your house.
Right now, Walt is placing Craigslist ads in major U.S. cities.
not the fun Cesar Romero Joker either.
Cool, I would have liked that.
I got to tell you though, the stretch goal that I'd really like to see is the Heroes of the Universe. So I loved when they did Project Superpowers. So I'd love to see the new renditions and how those would stack up.
One of the things about villains is that a lot of villains, their powers are totally dependent on the hero. We've talked about some of these even just tonight, like Venom and Carnage. These guys are evil twins, or they're actually dark mirrors. They're not actually an evil Peter Parker from another dimension, like, say, Overman. They are a character with the same powers as Spider-Man, but who uses their powers for evil. That Venom's a great example of that. So if you were going to do like a dark mirror archetype, well, what powers are you going to give him? I mean, you have to know who the hero is for the dark mirror to make any sense. So we have created a batch of heroes that live in this setting, and they're all modern riffs on public domain characters, like the Woman in Red and Amazing Man and Hugo Danner, the star of Gladiator. I think that's right. I get that right.
Yeah, Oscar Douglas.
And
also Tony Curtis, depending on which star you meant the Gladiator. Oh, Spartacus. I'm sorry, I was wrong. Russell Crowe.
Not that Gladiator.
Russell Crowe.
The book Gladiator. So we're gonna include that if we hit the right stretch goal. We will also write up all of those guys, the Hugo Danner and the Danner family, and the Woman in Red, and all those guys. Amazing Woman, because I wanted to do Amazing Woman. And the Black Fury, who's a gender-swapped version of Miss Fury, one of the first female superheroes. So we'll add all of those guys, which will be great. And also, we have to have them, because you can't write up the villain with all your powers until you know who all the heroes are. Right? This is the Amazo Super Skrull. What's the Marvel guy?
Super Skrull.
Not the Super Skrull, the one who has all the Avengers powers.
Super Adaptoid.
Super Adaptoid. Thank you, Chris. Yeah, exactly.
You're welcome.
You can't
Damn, Chris, you're a DC man.
Know who all the heroes are.
I'm a DC man who, the very first comic ever uncovered was a Captain America versus Super Adaptoid book.
Oh, nice. Good one. So anyway, so yeah, that's the Heroes of the Universe goal. We've got Super's versions of both the basic and expanded edition on there. And also Super Villain campaign support. We want to add essays on how to run Super Villain campaigns with all of these different premises, whether it's the Thunderbolts premise or the Suicide Mission Team premise or the Evil Villain Academy premise, where you're all playing like teenagers who are the children of supervillains. Or the story in which all the heroes have been killed by the villains, or have been killed by aliens or something, so the villains have to save the Earth.
I've heard that somewhere before.
Yeah, me too. Well, you know, it's got some legs, that idea. And so we want to support all of those as well. That's going to be about 5,000 words if we hit that goal. And we would like to add support for other game systems, but we're kind of waiting to see if we hit any of these goals before we start adding more of them.
Well, we're in talks right now with a nice fellow named... let me make sure. I keep saying his first name wrong. We've had him on the podcast twice, so I really, really shouldn't. But I did a lot of drugs in college. I'm just kidding. Ross Payton.
Yeah.
If you're familiar with the Base Raiders, it's... Yeah, that's him. I'm talking to him right now about doing a fake core conversion, because there's been a lot of enthusiasm on the fake core.
Yeah, and I just love fake. As a game system, it's great. And I think that it's great for this book as well, because fake core is very easily manipulated, and you can create new stunts, and it's very easy to add stuff. It's a game system that's very easy to manipulate.
So we're talking to Ross about that, and we'll see about that going forward. We're also considering Savage Worlds and even Gas Mutants and Masterminds.
Yep.
So we'll see. We've got polls up, actually, on the Ronin Army forum site. So if you're interested in seeing this resource, then please go to the poll we've got there on the Mutants and Masterminds general sub-forum on the Atomic Think Tank part of the Ronin Armies, and just vote yes, because we'll... going to base our decision on that kind of enthusiasm.
And you don't need to spend any money to do that. You just go to the forum and say, yes, I'd like to see it, and that would tell us what to do.
So, yeah. All right. Well, anything else we want to cover before we wrap things up? Anybody got any opinions that they want to
do? Chris, are you still doing your like Villain a Week project?
I am, and in fact, I got done with Hero High, my part of that, which the ransomware wiped out 80% of, but I finally rewrote the darn thing, and that's off, and now I'm back to making up my weekly villains.
Outstanding.
Now, that's going to be the Rogues Gallery product?
Yes.
Okay, and when does that start?
That is a Lighthouser question.
Okay, alright. So, Chris.
Sir.
About 2.5-3 years ago on this podcast, it was at a Lighthouser. Maybe the both of you announced that there was going to be a really kick-ass book about the cosmic side of the Freedom Verse. And we've been waiting anxiously. And can I ask you if we know when it's going to come out, or is that another Lighthouser question?
That you might want to start with Lighthouser. All I know is that I handed off my last draft in the summer of 2012, and I think I wrote a paragraph of fill text about a short time thereafter. I've seen the cover, and there you go. You know as much as I do.
Well, I'm shaking my magic eight ball, and it says, "Reply Hazy, try again." Whenever I ask someone for release dates on this podcast, I shake the magic eight ball to see what it says now.
Well, I tell you, I once watched one of the Futurama direct-to-DVD movies, and it ended with a preview of the next one, and they showed what footage they had and like cut into a trailer, and they announced that it was coming holiday 2010 or something like that. And I've just always said that, you know, we should always make all our release dates holiday whatever. And then, you know, we could just be coy, like, well, you know, I don't know why you're assuming that it was Mother's Day. We meant Flag Day.
We wanted to commemorate Christopher Columbus's discovery of the new year.
Absolutely.
So, all right, cool. So, that'll happen sometime, and when it comes out, it'll be great. And that's all we can say about that. So, all right. Cool. And, all right, Jason, Walt, Aid, anything else you guys wanted to weigh in on before we wrap it up?
The Joker is watching you, so make sure you back the Kickstarter.
Doug, come on in and take a look at the book, and I think you'll find it. It's really a lot of fun, and we put a lot of work into it. It's system neutral. It's got a lot of icon support in it, but it's great for anybody who plays superhero gaming. I worked my ass off on this book. I think you'll like it.
And it really shows too. Not only is the book gorgeous, but it reads very well. There's a lot of interesting quotes in it. There's tons of stuff in there. So even if you back for a dollar, just getting the manuscript, you're getting gold for pennies.
Yeah, and even if you're just a reader of comic books, it's a good resource just to know the genre from a critical angle. So.
And if you're a fan of the old Field Guide to Superheroes, by the way, if you read the Field Guide to Superheroes, which was the Heroes version of this book that we published through Vigilance, if you like that, this is the villain companion to that.
Published through who?
Vigilance.
I don't think I haven't heard of them.
Oh, don't be like that.
All right, sorry. All right. Well, hey, thanks everyone for coming out. This was a fun conversation. And we will catch you all next time on the Banff Podcast.